Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Joel Simon, has spent 15 years defending press freedoms. As the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, Joel and his team advocate for reporters who are under threat because of their journalism. He has led and participated in missions around the globe, from Argentina to Zimbabwe. In his new book, The New Censorship, Inside the Global Battle for Media Freedom, he argues that the battle for freedom of expression is the defining struggle of this moment. He writes, quote, "Despite the communication revolution spawned by technology, collective access to the essential information we need in a globalized world to make informed decisions about our lives and our future is by no means assured. State repression of the media is on the rise, though often hidden behind a democratic facade. The internet is threatened by increasingly effective national censorship regimes in places like China and Iran, and undermined by revelations of the unprecedented global surveillance effort carried by the U.S. National Security Agency." Joel Simon's new book is The New Censorship, and he joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. Hi, Joel. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be on. Thank you.
Well, it is great to have you. Thank you. And thank you for giving a voice to so many journalists who put their lives on the line around the globe. As we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, Joe, we start off on a positive note and highlight really good journalism that really stood out for you. So what struck you this week? What did you see?
I want to talk about a blog that was published by Foreign Policy, the website. And this really gets to the heart of what we're talking about and some of the arguments I make in the book, because this blog was written not by a professional journalist, but by an anonymous Chinese Weibo user. Weibo in China is like the it's like the Twitter and Facebook rolled up into one. And this was a young girl who, probably a teenager, we don't know exactly, who lived very close to where the Tianjin explosion took place. And as everyone knows, last month, this industrial zone, there was this horrific explosion. We don't know how many people were killed, but it was probably in the hundreds. And this young woman was injured very badly and described her ordeal and described her experience, including the strangers that came to help her, the treatment she received in the hospital, and the deficiencies of the Chinese authorities in responding to this emergency. And the Chinese government, this blog, which was translated from the Chinese and posted on Foreign Policy, received an unprecedented response in China from people who'd read it. And of course, the Chinese government responded by removing it and blocking it the way they always do when these kinds of revelations are made. So this was an incredible piece of journalism. It was not done by a professional journalist. It was done by an average person who was using these tools that are available now, even in China, to expose this reality and call attention to it. But the Chinese government responded not by addressing these concerns, but by censoring this Weibo post. And I think Foreign Policy did a great service by translating it and posting it on their blog.
It's so interesting because there are so many of these blogs. You just have to really look for them. But what are your thoughts about just what's involved in finding this information in the first place? I mean, it's great that Foreign Policy highlighted this, but it makes you think about so many of the other stories that people are writing that don't get highlighted by national outlets.
Yes, of course, and again, that's part of this reality in which as I note in my book, the deluge of information can be so overwhelming that it blinds us to the gaps in our knowledge. And so you're right. It is really, you know, if you put the energy in and you know where to go and you're engaged, you can find this information in many instances. Not always. We can talk about why it's not always available. But for many people, it is. But it still remains an extraordinary. It takes a level of engagement that not everyone is able or willing to put in to find this information. And so that results in a kind of hierarchy in which certain people, certain institutions who make the effort have access to information, and other people who might benefit from it but are not in a position to put in that effort don't have it.
So let's talk a little bit about what is happening in China, since you brought up China. In your book, you write that the Chinese government has developed strategies combining traditional forms of repression with high techniques like using software to filter out prohibited content. News gatherers in China face a myriad of restrictions. Talk about some of those.
Remember that adage, you know, that the internet is impossible to censor or control, that you can't, you know, that information wants to be free, and as long as people have access to the internet, eventually these authoritarian systems will collapse. Remember that argument? It was a kind of utopian argument. You don't hear that anymore because China has effectively proved it wrong. Mm-hmm. China has demonstrated that you can have connectivity. China has more people online than any country in the world. The number's growing. People in China who are online have a very rich experience. They have access to shopping, they have access to entertainment, they have access to all sorts of important news and information. But the Chinese government at the same time has managed to construct a pretty effective system for monitoring and controlling information and creating what's often called the Great Firewall, which is creating a sort of internal domestic intranet which they can manage and control. So China is a powerful counterexample and a successful one that shows that it is possible to control and manage information even with these new technologies.
So let's spend some time on this, because you write extensively in your new book, The New Censorship, about how technology has changed censorship globally. We've listened, we've heard stories about some of the new technologies that are used by various countries, but what really strikes you right now? What's not getting the attention you think it deserves?
You mean in terms of stories or in terms of these new strategies?
The new technologies.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the main thing is that we have all this new technology. We're in the midst of an information revolution. It's completely transformed the global media. It's completely transformed the way in which people around the world access and share information. And yet, if you look at the data, this is the most deadly and dangerous time ever for journalists. More journalists are being killed than ever before. Mm. More journalists are in prison than ever before. We're seeing countries and governments respond effectively to the challenges posed to them by information. They understand the threat very well. They've seen what happens when you don't control information. We have the Arab revolutions is an example, and there are others. So they're really engaged in an effective counter response to these technologies. And then you have groups like the Islamic State, which are exploiting the technology directly to disseminate their own messages of terror and bypassing the traditional media. So you take all these factors together and you realize that while technology has transformed the way information is gathered and shared around the world and also had many, many positive impacts, there are some very negative consequences that we're not effectively mitigating. And what we're seeing on the ground is that more journalists are in jail, more journalists are in prison than at any time in recent history.
According to your website, 43 journalists were killed in 2015 so far?
Yes. And you know, I should point out that there are many, many other cases that are under investigation, particularly in Syria and Iraq and even in Mexico, where sometimes it's very hard to gather enough information to make an informed judgment about whether somebody was killed because of their journalism or not, because there's this information void. It's exactly the problem I'm talking about. We know so little about what's happening inside Syria that sometimes we cannot even make a judgment about why an individual was killed. So I expect that number to go up again. And if you look at the last couple of years and you look at the cumulative total, these have been record years. These, you know, particularly because of Syria, but really because of global trends, the number of journalistic casualties has reached unprecedented proportions. And again, the number of journalists in prison around the world has also hit record numbers.
So 43 journalists killed so far this year. Last year, that number was 61.
Yes, correct. And if you go back Consistently over the last few years, you see the numbers are in the 60s and 70s. And if you go back previously, so in the sort of decade before that, really this trend began with the Iraq invasion in 2002, and then going forward into you know the current day. If you look at the number of journalists killed in this period, this decade has been about 50% greater than the previous decade. So this is the era in which technology has transformed the way the media works, and this is the era in which we're seeing record casualties among journalists.
I'm speaking with Joel Simon, Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. He's out with a new book, The New Censorship, Inside the Global Battle for Media Freedom. He argues that the battle for freedom of expression is the defining struggle of this moment. We're talking about journalists that have been jailed, journalists that have been killed. And in part of your book, you write that the internet, which has obviously become the key piece of infrastructure in the global news system, is threatened by increasingly effective national censorship regimes in places like China, we were just talking about that, also Iran, and undermined by revelations of the unprecedented global surveillance effort carried out by the U.S. National Security Agency. So, for example, in Iran, how are you able to keep track of what journalists there are facing?
Well, Iran is a pretty dynamic environment. It's last year it was the world's leading jailer of journalists, and each year it's neck and neck with China. But there is a dynamic media in Iran that actually reports on the political developments. But it's precisely because the lines are constantly shifting that the government responds to this kind of critical coverage by rounding up journalists and putting them in jail. And they have a pretty Iran is a place where there's an active online community, but it's carefully monitored and controlled. And the government authorities also have taken action against individuals who've used these technologies to express critical ideas. And we have, you know, the leading example of this is the Washington Post correspondent Jason Rezaian, who has been in jail in Iran now for well over a year, and he's accused of espionage. The charges are very vague. We expect that there'll be a verdict soon in his case, but we don't know when, and we certainly don't know what it will be. But this is the Washington Post correspondent. This is an unprecedented step that Iran would jail a correspondent for a major U.S. media organization for this period of time. And if they're willing to take this action against a reporter with this visibility, you can imagine the challenges that Iranian journalists face on a daily basis.
And so give us an update on this campaign. I mean, if you're searching for information about Jason, you can find it, but it's not getting as much attention as it was even 6 months ago.
I think there's a kind of fatigue. It's a challenge. You know, we do this every day, and what we try and do is, you know, we try to mobilize the media on behalf of their colleagues. But the fact that Jason Rezaian is in jail and days are going by is not as newsworthy as it was. It should be, because this is, as I said, an unprecedented step by the Iranian government, and it's particularly noteworthy in the context of the ongoing discussion about the nuclear deal.
Right.
So I think, you know, I'm in touch with Jason's family and with the Washington Post every day. People are absolutely working tirelessly to try and resolve this situation and bring him home. But I think as far as the media is concerned, it's more challenging and more difficult to sustain regular coverage.
I'm speaking with Joel Simon, Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. He's out with a new book, The New Censorship, Inside the Global Battle for Media Freedom, and he's arguing that the battle for freedom of expression is the defining struggle of this moment. Again, this year, 43 journalists have already been killed around the world. Last year, it was 61 total. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions for Joel about media freedom, about the struggle that journalists face around the world, the new technologies that various regimes are using to censor journalists. Give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. In an interview with NPR, Joel, Iran's head of parliament hinted that the Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian, who's in jail, has been in jail for a little over a year on espionage charges, could be part of a prisoner's exchange. There are other journalists who are in jail in Iran, and because of the nuclear deal, a freedom of the press is not really seriously scrutinized by American reporters. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I don't know, and I don't know if that's even being discussed. I mean, I think that we have to really maintain an absolutist position in the way we discuss Jason Rezaian's situation. It is an absolute outrage that he is in prison. It is an outrage that he has been deprived of any modicum of due process. It is an outrage that his health has deteriorated in prison. It is an outrage that he is not given regular access to his family. The trial, so-called, is a farce. It's a charade. He's, you know, I've called him a judicial hostage. That's what he is. This is not a legal process in any meaningful sense of the word. There's a kind of upset. This won't surprise people who follow Iranian politics even remotely, but there's a sort of obsession with hostages and hostage taking in Iran, and they're often used for political purposes. And the prevailing theory is that hardliners within the government who wanted the ability to sort of sabotage the nuclear negotiations if they went in a direction that didn't please them are behind Jason Rezaian's imprisonment. We don't know if that's precisely the case, but many informed observers believe that. So I think that obviously we want to bring Jason home as soon as possible, but I really hope that this can be resolved by the Iranian legal system declaring Jason innocent of all these charges and releasing him so that he can come home and return to his reporting.
What are your thoughts about just talk about swapping journalists?
Well, I mean, I think that I can't think of many examples where that's occurred, but I mean, I think the notion that journalists are somehow hostages or political prisoners or bargaining chips in any sense undermines the role that they need to play in order to do their jobs effectively, which is to operate outside of these kinds of political considerations. And I think this is one of the reasons, we're talking about Jason Rezaian's case in Iran, but if you look around the world, we have the Al Jazeera case in Egypt, in which three journalists for Al Jazeera English, very well-respected, very well-regarded international journalists, have now been sentenced to prison after another charade of a legal process. You have the leading investigative journalist in Azerbaijan, a woman named Khadija Ismailova, who was just sentenced to 7.5 years in prison, also on trumped-up charges. She's someone who has been very well-regarded internationally. This is also an outrage. So you see that governments around the world who might traditionally be reluctant to take these kinds of repressive actions against the media are no longer reluctant and to do so. And I think this has to do, going back to the discussions we had about technology, as a result of the changing power dynamic between the media and government. And this plays out in different ways in different parts of the world.
Joel Simon is executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. His new book is The New Censorship, Inside the Global Battle for Media Freedom. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And before the break, I wanted to ask you about today is 9/11, and there are a lot of people are talking about, looking back, the so-called war on terror, what really strikes me about this is over the years, we've all often asked, what have the media really learned from what happened on 9/11 and the lead up to the invasion of Iraq? And it's kind of amazing to see Dick Cheney. He wrote a new book with his daughter, and he's going on all of the television shows. Very softball questions are being asked. Actually, some of the Fox hosts have asked some of the toughest questions of Dick Cheney. And he's talking about the Iran deal. And it's kind of surreal because hardly anyone is asking him about the invasion of Iraq. What are your thoughts on that?
When I think about 9/11 and the legacy of, you know, Cheney's legacy in terms of global press freedom, you know, I think about this whole war on terror rubric and the either you're with us or against us and the kind of framing that the administration had in that moment in time in terms of the role of the media in supporting the government in a moment of crisis. And the lasting negative impact that has had around the world, because that was an absolute gift to repressive governments. We saw in the aftermath of 9/11, I've been talking about, this is the record numbers of journalists in prison. Well, if you looked at the data, basically following 9/11, we do an annual census at the Committee to Protect Journalists of Journalists in Prison around the world, and it skyrocketed. It went up. And it stayed up. And the reason was that repressive governments around the world were using this anti-terror framework that they adopted from the Bush administration, and they were able to implement anti-terror laws that were sweeping and vague, and they were able to frame critical journalists as supporting terrorists. And this is a legacy that continues to this day. I could talk about Ethiopia, which has one of the leading jailers of journalists in Africa, which has a sweeping anti-terror law, which they claim is modeled based on international norms, or Turkey, where they have also been one of the world's leading jailer of journalists, and they've framed the debate in exactly the same way. So I see a lasting global impact, which we have yet to overcome, from what I consider to be a kind of reckless response to this particular moment, which was obviously traumatic, but countries around the world live through these kinds of traumatic events, and the fact that the U.S. Used it as an opportunity to criticize the media and seek to control it gave them license, and we're seeing that play out to this day.
What do you think explains, though, the softball questions asked to someone like Dick Cheney, who's, you know, doing the rounds again for yet another book talking about Iran? I mean, even the New York Times in 2014 suggested war crime prosecutions of Dick Cheney.
You know, I'm going to be perfectly honest. I have not even watched. You know, I mean, I've been reading about what he's been saying, but I haven't watched the interview, so I don't know. I mean, there's always a dynamic with journalists about in terms of access, and maybe they're concerned that they won't get the interview if they're too tough. I really have no idea, because I have not, you know, I made it a point. I want to be informed about, what he's saying, but I don't feel I'm going to learn anything from watching these interviews. So I frankly have not watched them.
Joel Simon is executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. He and his team advocate for reporters who are under threat because of their reporting. And he's out with a new book, The New Censorship: Inside the Global Battle for Media Freedom. And he argues that the battle for freedom of expression is the defining struggle of this moment. They keep extensive track of censorship around the globe, journalists who've been imprisoned and journalists who've been killed, 43 so far this year. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
And you're listening to Your Call on KALW in San Francisco. I'm Matt Martin, here with Joe Burke, asking for your support in this hour of Your Call, the Media Roundtable, a time when I know many people tune in to hear Rose and her guests talk about the state of journalism, talk about the stories of the week. Your support makes this conversation possible.
You're right, Matt. Listener support makes KALW the special place that it is. And Your Call with Rose Aguilar is an example of one of the many programs that are produced right here at Local Public Radio with donations from KALW listeners. listeners and supporters. So please join us today, 800-525-9917, or online at kalw.org.
And we have Joel Simon's book, The New Censorship, Inside the Battle for Media Freedom, yours for a $120 contribution to KALW. You can look at it and learn more about the station at kalw.org or talk to a phone room volunteer at 800-525-9917.
And all of your support goes right back into the programming here at KALW. Nearly three-quarters of our annual operating budget comes directly from listeners, and it produces programs like Your Call with Rose Aguilar. Please join us today, 800-525-9917. Innovative programming like you hear every weekday morning at 10 o'clock only happens when the community comes together in support. Here's the number to call.
800-525-9917. Thank you so much for that call right there. Join that person. Come together with us. The Media Roundtable is about lifting up journalists who are doing great work and, you know, often doing work that is risky. Folks like this take risks for us so we can have the information. Our responsibility is to speak up for them, to defend them. That's what Joel Simon does in his work for the Committee to Protect Journalists. But also to ask for your support, to be part of this ecology where this great journalistic work is brought forward, where you can discover reporters who may not be in the biggest newspapers, who may not always be on the news hour, but who do important work. That's what you discover, and that's what you support when you call 800-525-9917 or go to kalw.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's our media roundtable, and today we are speaking with Joel Simon, executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Joel is out with a new book called The New Censorship, Inside the Global Battle for Media Freedom. And if you have any questions for Joel about censorship, about what journalists are currently facing today because of new technologies, and so many journalists imprisoned around the globe, again, 43 journalists have been killed so far this year. Last year, it was 61. Since 1992, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, 1,141 journalists have been killed. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from John in Oakland. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. Say, I'd like to just bring up the subject of Gary Webb, Gary Webb's Dark Alliance, and this is a case of censorship in the extreme that happened here in California, and I kind of wonder how it looks to say foreign journalists that we are so concerned about global censorship when a story the size of Gary Webb's could go by the wayside. With the Monica Lewinsky distraction mode. So I'd appreciate if you just comment on Gary Webb's Dark Alliance.
All right, thank you for that.
Well, I was living in California when that was that series was published, and of course I remember it well. Gary Webb documented a CIA, alleged CIA operation, which allowed drug traffickers in Los Angeles to sell crack cocaine, which was imported with the a wink and a nod from the CIA, and then they used the proceeds of that to buy weapons to arm the Contras. And, of course, this created a tremendous splash, and it also created a powerful opposition from elements of the U.S. government who were stung by these revelations. And the series has remained controversial to this day. There was a recent movie made about it, which was I thought was a wonderful movie and recommend it. I think, honestly, if you look at this from a global perspective, certainly it was a dramatic moment in terms of press freedom in the United States. But I think if you look at this from a global perspective, what really is providing cover for repressive governments around the world in terms of U.S. policies are some of the things I already mentioned. One is this framing of of terror and of journalists who cover groups that are quote unquote terrorist groups. If the journalists who cover those are somehow tainted by that and accused of supporting terrorism themselves, and that's something we see happening around the world. And I also think there was a lot of attention attention certainly focused on the way the United States government responded to the Snowden revelations. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of concern, obviously, about the NSA, the scale of the NSA spying, surveillance, and that has certainly emboldened governments around the world in terms of measures they take to control and monitor online speech within their own country. So those to me are the most pressing examples that are exploited by repressive governments around the world to both justify their own actions and to undermine U.S. soft power when it comes to advocating on behalf of journalists and press freedom around the world.
And that film about Gary Webb is called Kill the Messenger. And we did an amazing film. We did a few shows about it. And you can search for that at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for that call. You can give us a call if you'd like to join our conversation with Joel Simon. He's executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. His new book is The New Censorship: Inside the Global Battle for Media Freedom. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And since we're talking about press freedoms and press repression in the United States, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the New York Times reporter James Risen, who has also been on this show. And he called President Obama the greatest enemy of press freedom in a generation. Of course, he faced jail time because he refused to reveal a source and testify against a former CIA agent accused of leaking secrets to James Risen.
Yeah, I think he's got a point. At CPJ, you know, historically we're a frontline organization. We focus on places, you know, where these issues are life and death. But a couple years ago, we did a report, the first ever comprehensive report on the United States. It's called Obama and the Press, and it was written by Leonard Downey Jr., the former executive editor of the Washington Post. And he did a comprehensive examination of President Obama's press freedom policies, looking at prosecutions of journalists under the Espionage Act, aggressive actions taken to curtail leaks within the government and punish leakers who interact with the media, the failure to really implement freedom of information policies that would lead to the release of more government information. And this report had a very significant impact. And a number of people quoted in the report who covered Washington for a long time called President Obama, you know, the most anti-press president since Nixon. One journalist who covers him regularly called him a control freak. So certainly the relationship between reporters in Washington who are trying to cover the actions of the Obama administration and the president have been poor. We've seen some positive steps recently. Certainly it's a good thing that James Risen is not going to jail, that situation has been resolved. There have been some new guidelines, Justice Department guidelines, which govern the circumstances in which journalists can be subpoenaed, have been promulgated, and that's certainly a positive step. But the relationship between the press and the Obama administration is a troubled one, and I do think this is damaging to U.S. credibility on these issues around the world. And from where I sit, it's damaging because it undermines the ability of the U.S. officials to advocate effectively on behalf of journalists around the world who are facing repression from their own governments, because these governments like nothing more than to toss the Obama administration's record back in the face of these officials.
In your book, you write about talking to heads of states about their dismal press freedoms, like in countries like Turkey and Pakistan. Do they bring up the United States and its rhetoric about the war on terror and national security?
It's their favorite topic. Sure, yeah. That's the first thing you deal with, and that's one reason we felt that we really needed to do a report looking at the U.S. press freedom record, because we wanted to make clear to these governments that we are calling them as we see it. We are really defending journalists around the world. We're not defending any government or government policies. In fact, CPJ makes a point of accepting no government money. You know, and while I you know, parry these kinds of arguments, you know, at the end of the day, I obviously believe that these governments are responsible for their own actions and are looking for any excuse that can justify them. It's unfortunate that the U.S. policies have provided them with a convenient excuse, but I also believe that if they didn't have that excuse, they would find another, because these are governments that are at war with information. Last year, about a year ago, I had a chance to meet with President Erdogan of Turkey as part of a CPJ delegation, and Turkey has been one of the world's leading jailer of journalists. Repression has actually been rising in recent months. There have been a number of very troubling actions, including the arrest of a couple of Vice reporters, and their Iraqi stringer fixer who worked with them is still in prison in Turkey. And what President Erdogan told us, he said to us right at the start of this meeting, I am increasingly against the internet every day.
Hmm.
I'm increasingly against the internet every day. Of course, I appreciated the fact that he was so forthcoming and laid this on the line. And it occurred to me that if this is how he speaks to a press freedom delegation, imagine what he says in private. There is a whole generation of these kinds of repressive leaders. I actually, in my book, I call them democratators. These are leaders who govern with the support of a significant portion of the population, who can win elections, but who carry out repressive policies and try to hide them behind this democratic facade. And this is a phenomena that you see in many parts of the world that has very significant implications for press freedom and the work of journalists.
What did you say when Erdogan told you that he, you know, is not a fan of the internet? Well, how did you respond to that?
Well, you know, we had a lot of issues that we sort of engaged. My head sort of spun. I mean, to be perfectly frank, he was talking about it in the context of the fact that the Islamic State was using the internet to recruit followers. But really, within Turkey, the internet has been a safety valve for critical journalism, because so much of the media is beholden to the government, and the government itself has taken repressive measures to curtail and constrain media. It's shut down Twitter on a number of occasions. It's arrested people who've used social media to post critical comments and revelations about the government. So, you know, we had a whole host of issues. And we tried to push back a little bit, but it was interesting because normally in these meetings with heads of state, they sort of start out the meeting by saying, well, of course, the work of journalists is important. You know, press freedom is vital to a democracy. We believe that. But what was interesting about Erdogan is he made no pretenses. He really cast journalists as enemies. He went after the New York Times. He went after CNN. He went after social media. He went after the internet. So this was a barrage which we tried to parry. But, we've seen subsequently that he was really speaking his mind, and he really sees the media, and he's not alone in this, and information that's available to the public as a threat to his long-term political interests, and he's committed to taking the steps he needs to take to maintain his own position and power within the Turkish society.
And according to reports, the Dutch journalist who was deported from Turkey, Frederik Geerdink, says that she wants to return as soon as possible. She says, as much fun and violence-free the Netherlands may be, it's not for me. There's work to do for journalists in Turkey.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, she's someone who's been involved in many cases and who we've defended, and she's reporting on a part of Turkey that is obviously undercovered. It's undercovered by Turkish journalists. It's undercovered by the international media, and Turkey is at the confluence of a global story that involves obviously the Islamic State and the future of Syria and the regional stability and the Kurdish insurgency is at the heart of this, and whether it's possible to get the peace negotiations, which were underway, back on track, or whether we're headed towards an increased military escalation, which we seem to be. These are vital stories that have tremendous global implications, and Turkey is determined not only to suppress coverage of this within its own country, but globally. I mean, and another way to think about this is, if I can cite the phrase that Lee Bollinger, president of Columbia University, who's also written widely on these topics, a sort of phrase that he coined, which is, in a global information ecosystem, censorship anywhere is censorship everywhere. So the fact that there's censorship of within the Kurdish region of Turkey not only affects people in Turkey, it affects people all around the globe who have an interest in this information, interest in what's happening there, a stake. And so effectively, this is a form of global censorship.
I'm speaking with Joel Simon, Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. He's out with a new book, The New Censorship, Inside the Global Battle for Media Freedom. And if you have a question or comment for Joel about censorship around the globe, censorship in the United States, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. Or press freedom, the crackdown on journalists who are being imprisoned. So far, 43 journalists have been killed this year. 61 were killed last year. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go to our next caller, John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose, and thank you for taking my call. We're reaching toward the end of the Obama administration, and it seems to me the problem with President Obama is that he dislikes controversy. In fact, Ralph Nader has commented on this, and as well as others. He avoids controversy, and he may have convictions on something, but he lacks the courage of his convictions. And as a consequence, this problem we're having with press freedom is that he gives in to the demands of the NSA and the CIA and the rest of them. He just gives them what they want because he doesn't want to be bothered fighting them. He has no mechanism internally to combat these people. And that's my issue.
Thank you for calling. John, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, just to respond to John, I mean, I don't have any, insight into what motivates President Obama in regards to his relationship with the sort of national security establishment. But I will say that based on our own reporting, that he definitely is inclined to run, a very disciplined kind of team. And he takes it very personally when there are leaks. And he takes it very personally, not only when those leaks are within his close circle, but when those leaks are from even agencies and other parts of the government with which he's not directly interacting. And we've seen policies that the administration has implemented that have a very chilling and intimidating effect. And this effect is not just on journalists, but it's on people within the government who routinely interact with journalists and provide them with information which helps inform the public debate. And this is, this is one of these things that has always gone on in government. It sometimes happens with a bit of a wink and a nod. It's an understanding that, that this is kind of, the administration may not love every leak, but a recognition that having this information flow to the public does produce, a robust and informed debate and lead to better outcomes and better policies. And sometimes I think that Obama doesn't believe that. Sometimes I think he's so convinced with controlling and managing the message and that he that he's, you know, taking very aggressive action to limit this kind of what I consider to be routine engagement with the media, that our policy debates and our discussions about these critical issues are not as informed as they should be. And this is really part of the new censorship. I mean, the way it plays out in the United States is perhaps less dramatic than it plays out in Turkey or Iran or China or other places. But really, this at its root, this is a fundamental recalibration in the relationship between the media and governments. And governments have other ways of communicating with the public. They have other ways of getting their message out. The media is less essential. It's sometimes presented as an interest group that can be managed and controlled. And I think that's a global dynamic that plays out differently in different countries and in different societies.
Well, thank you for the call, John. Today, we're joined by Joel Simon, Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. He's out with a new book, The New Censorship, Inside the Global Battle for Media Freedom. And Joel, we have just a couple minutes left, but I wanted you to tell the story about what happened in Pakistan. This is from the introduction of your book. You talk about arriving in Islamabad on May 1st, 2011, 2 days in advance of your team's meeting with President Asif Ali Zardari. Talk about what happened when you met.
Yeah, well, that was, we were, you know, Pakistan is one of the most deadly countries in the world for journalists. And, of course, many people may be familiar with the murder of Danny Pearl, the Wall Street Journal correspondent who was kidnapped and executed by al-Qaeda in late 2001, early 2002. And there was a prosecution and conviction in that case. It was but it was the only one. There had been more than 30 Pakistani journalists killed subsequently with almost no investigation and certainly no convictions. And so we put together a delegation from CPJ to travel to Islamabad to meet with the president. And the day before our meeting, I woke up and there were already, I think actually somebody woke me up with a call from New York saying that there was just a raid and Osama bin Laden was killed. And so the whole country was sort of tossed into this turmoil. And what was really interesting that happened was a lot of people were calling me and saying, there are going to be riots. People are going to be, you know, pouring into the streets. And you need to stay put and stay safe. And of course, being on the scene in Islamabad, it was quickly clear that this was not going to happen, and that there was very little public protest. There were some small protests in Karachi, and life sort of went on, and it was really the Pakistani media that was getting beyond this hysterical reporting that I was seeing. You know, it was coming back at me from people outside the country reporting on what was happening in Pakistan, and they were simply not informed. But I was able to turn to the Pakistani media and get a much better sense of the reality. They were on the scene first in Abbottabad, where this raid took place. They were reporting quite aggressively about the aftermath and the political consequences. And as a matter of fact, we went ahead and we had our meeting with the president, and we raised our concerns. And we got some significant commitments from the president in terms of investigating these outstanding cases. That was gratifying in the moment. I am sorry to say, though, that the situation in Pakistan has not improved, and it remains a deadly and dangerous country for journalists.
Well, and this also speaks to the value of local journalists and also bringing, you know, giving them a voice, because the work they do is so crucial.
That was absolutely the lesson for me. It was really kind of interesting to be in the middle of that and to see, you know, how uninformed and how hysterical, frankly, the reporting was from the international media compared to the local media, which really had the context and the ability to sort of sort through the rumors and sort through the exaggerations, and thank God I was able to actually interact with Pakistani journalists and the Pakistani media because I was much better informed as a result.
Joel Simon is Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists and author of the new book, The New Censorship, Inside the Global Battle for Media Freedom. Joel, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
And I'm Matt Martin, joining Rose here in Studio B at KALW as we are wrapping up the media roundtable and getting ready for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting that will be coming up at 11 o'clock. But before that program begins, we want to ask for your support. If you are a media roundtable listener, if you value your call, if you like the fact that there's an independent source of information here in the Bay Area called KALW, we ask you to get involved right now to make a call at 800-525-9917 or go to kalw.org.
800-525-9917 or go online to kalw.org. Thank you so much for your support. For a $120 contribution, we will send you Joel Simon's book, The New Censorship. And as Joel said, local journalists are so valuable, and I love that we're able to bring on so many local journalists from around the globe. Matt, Malihe Raz is on. Our producer does such a good job of finding these amazing journalists. It's easy to rip on the media. I do it a lot.
Yeah.
But there's so much good journalism out there that doesn't get the attention it deserves. So if you appreciate that, and if you value that like we do, give us a call, 800-525-9917 or online, kalw.org.
And your support right now can make a real difference because we have a challenge in this hour to get 15 people to support KALW. And if that happens, 15 people at any level of support. We've had people give $50 this morning. Earlier, we had a $900 contribution. At every level of support, you will help us toward this challenge, which would mean an additional $365 for KALW. Let's do this together. It's Friday. You can go into the weekend saying, yeah, I supported Rose and her team. I made sure that KALW, which I depend on, is strong. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
We cannot do this without your support. As Matt said, 15 calls or clicks at any level of support, and we will get an additional
$365.
Thank you. It's been a long week.
Sorry.
800-525-9917 or online, KALW.org. We always look forward to Friday's shows, thinking about what we want to focus on, what was the top story of the week, how can we do it differently, what voices are out there that aren't being heard. Support that kind of radio. 800-525-9917. And the other thing that I love to do on Friday is to team up a reporter with, say, McClatchy, with an independent reporter from Slate, for example. And sometimes they like to talk offline. Maybe they don't even know about each other's work, but they connect on the radio. And it's great to have that national reporter with the international reporter and the independent reporter. Support that kind of radio. 800-525-9917 or online, KALW.org.
I mean, there are a lot of weekend review shows in the world of media.
Right.
Your Call's Media Roundtable does something different, and that is to bring you closer to that process of journalism. And like Rose says, to get people talking to one another who might not otherwise, making connections between different dots in the globe and different stories that might not be made otherwise. We have an open line right now at 800-525-9917. Make that connection right now for us. This is how we do it, and it keeps this source of information independent. That's what it's about. KALW.org, listener supported for nearly 75 years. Be the next person to call.
800-525-9917 or kalw.org. We pay attention to the horse race, but we usually don't talk about it. We try to take a very different angle on that horse race. I'm talking about the presidential election, of course. So if you appreciate that kind of programming, give us a call, 800-525-9917. This week on this show, you haven't heard one of the words that you're hearing everywhere else in the media.
I'm dying to hear what this word is.
Starts with a T. And if you appreciate that kind of programming, give us a call at 800-525-9917 or online, kalw.org.
There's a couple of names I do want to mention. Maura in San Francisco, she called 800-525-9917, says she loves Rose Aguilar. Maura, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joe Balderrama in Fremont says he appreciates KALW, and he gave his support to keep it strong right now. In these next 2 minutes, if we're going to make it to this challenge, we need to have a flurry of support. Be one of those people who helps us go over the edge of this challenge. Final minutes, 800-525-9917. Joel Simon's book, The New Censorship, which looks at all kinds of elements of how journalism works today and what the threats are to its freedom, which aren't, you know, sometimes it's about oppressive governments, but it's also about technology. It's also about resources. Your support keeps this conversation going. And here on KALW San Francisco, we love being listener supported. We don't have much time, Rose. Give them the number.
800-525-9917 or kalw.org.
800-525-9917. 525-9917. Thank you for that call right there. Be the next person to get in touch to support KALW. Get Joel Simon's new book for a $120 contribution and know that you've taken part in media you can believe in and participate in.
800-525-9917, KALW.org. Support radio. We give a voice to James Risen, for example. We had him on, the New York Times reporter. Someone called in about Gary Webb. We did a show about that really good film, Kill the Messenger. Support this kind of programming. We cannot do it without your support. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org. Just a couple seconds, 15 calls or clicks. We'll get an extra $365. 800-525-9917.
Or KALW.org. You can see Joel Simon's book there. Every contribution that comes in until the end of the news headlines counts towards this challenge. So be counted. Show your support. Thanks.
Thank you.